I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I have to admit, after working for 15 years in food media, there are some stories that I just hear over and over and over again, and some of which I have been guilty of churning out into the world myself. Sorry. You know, but like stuff like how this chef learned to cook at their grandmother's knee, or how this one week in the Italian countryside changed the chef's life, or most embarrassingly, what's in the chef's fridge at home? Don't bother. It's always a six-pack of beer and a bottle of ketchup, and guess what? No one actually cares. But something I realized I really do love talking with chefs about is what they make at home for the holidays. Because that's the one time when their families don't let them clock out, and because they're cooking for family, it's usually not about showing off. It's about the old traditions they keep and the new traditions they bring to the table. So this week, we have a bunch of great conversations and ideas about family holiday cooking and gifting. From pastry superstar Christina Tozzi's favorite four-ingredient cookie, to the potato soup the chef Victor Albizu first tasted in the streets of Peru, to a chat with the journalist Liana Agajanian about a box of chocolate the whole world secretly loves. But first, Maddie Matheson. I don't know, Maddie might actually go down as the greatest Canadian in history, and I know there are a lot of great Canadians, but only he has hosted a show called Keep It Canada, where he climbed a literal mountain of potatoes and said that being called an honorary Calgarian made him feel like he was in Star Trek. He's a chef, a newly minted best-selling cookbook author, and just a good dude. Maddie Matheson.
Hello, Francis.
Oh, it's good to talk to you, my friend.
Oh, it's always nice to talk to you.
Congratulations to you on being a New York Times best-selling author.
Thank you very much.
You get to take that to the grave with you.
I know, it's unreal.
The world needs its bologna bowls.
Dude, it's wild. I made this beautiful cookbook, and now everyone just gravitates right towards the bologna. I put an inside joke in this cookbook. And people love it. I don't know. It's a funny thing, you know? You can't control it.
It's your mother-in-law's bologna bowl. It is several slices of bologna with a piece of cheese and an egg and microwaved until it's a beautiful bowl. It's a complete breakfast.
It is a bowl. It's just, honest. There's no rhyme or reason to it. It's just, a mother of five kids had to make a lot of quick breakfasts in the morning, and that was it. And then when I had it, I was like, what is this? And then, the rest is history on the bologna bowl.
Yeah, you became the honorary sixth kid.
Yeah, I'm a New York Times bestseller with a friggin' bologna bowl. So anyone can do it, kids. It's that easy.
So I love this book. Congratulations to you. I love all stories about your family. And I want to talk to you today about holiday eating. Mm. Holiday eating, let's face it, is basically just winter eating. And Canada pretty much invented winter. So as a Canadian, what are some things Americans should be eating this holiday season that we don't already?
See, it's tough because it's we're the bizarro mirror to America, right? It's just we have almost the same land. I think our land mass is bigger and we have, only 30 million people and you guys have 300. So it's just it's kind of the same. We have the same European, weird North America. We have turkey and you have sweet potatoes and you have, mashed potatoes and broccoli with cheese sauce or if you're fancy, Mornay sauce. And do you put cranberries in your stuffing? Do you put water chestnuts in your stuffing? Do you put sausage in your stuffing? There's so many weird kind of things, but
the same controversies.
It's the same. Yeah. And it's a funny thing. And I grew up, I'm from the Maritimes and we had every Christmas Eve, we've had the same meal my entire life. I've never had something different. 36 years, I have had one dish, and it's called a rape pie.
Yes.
And the rape pie is an Acadian dish that is even a lot of Acadians don't even make. Okay. It's a thing that is getting lost, and it's you take potatoes, you peel them, you grate them, and you squeeze all of the moisture out of them, and then you kind of vac pack them and freeze these blocks of potato starch, pretty much.
Huh. You would do that at home.
Well, yeah, back in the day, my grandmother would grate potatoes and squeeze them out in like almost like pillowcases.
Okay.
And then hang them up in the rafters in the barn. And then you would keep them. And because once you get out of the moisture, they won't like ferment, right? And then you reconstitute it with hot chicken stock or like a fish stock. It depends on like whatever you had or like a rabbit stock. Like my grandmother, when she grew up eating raw pie, she's an Acadian. And when she grew up, they would be like whatever we had. So like if you had mussels, if you had salt cod, if you had rabbit, if you had, you know, just like maybe some beef shin or if you had chicken. Or pigeon or duck, whatever it was. And our family, we always had chicken. And so you just make like a very gentle chicken stock. You boil like a whole chicken. You add literally like green onions. That's it. Salt. Not even a lot of salt. And then you take that boiling chicken stock and you reconstitute the potato.
Okay.
Almost like a polenta.
Oh,
and so you stir and stir and stir and stir. And then you take all the chicken meat off. And you make it almost like soupy. It looks very soupy, this potato mass. And then you pour that into a like a baking tray, and you bake it. And it's almost like a solidified chicken pot pie, but with nothing in it except for chicken and potato. And that's like a Matheson family. Like that is like the only thing. And I kind of write about it in the book where I'm like, I'm very much just a very white, non-traditional Canadian family. You know, like we don't have a lot of traditions except for that one is our only like real food tradition. But besides that, we always had that on Christmas Eve. And then on Christmas Day, we always had goose and duck.
Okay.
Because we always thought like turkey was always kind of like every other kind of lesser kind of holiday. But for Christmas, we always had roasted duck, roasted goose. Even like last year, we smoked some ducks. Made a little glaze with some like cognac, some whiskey, some orange juice, and like some hoisin. Because I just used whatever my parents had. Now I like to do like non-traditional stuff.
Mm-hmm.
2 years ago, I just made like larb.
Oh, right off.
We just had like a giant larb feast, and which was like super funny. I was just like, why don't we do this? And my parents were like, okay, because they kind of trust me.
Let me tell you one thing I read in your book that I want to make for my holiday table. Hopefully this year. Your dad's lobster bisque.
Yeah.
It sounds bananas. Reading the recipe, it was like there were like plot twists in that recipe.
Yeah.
Like I'm like, whoa, where'd chicken stock come from? It's like, caramelized vegetables. These are not things that go in a normal lobster bisque. Tell me about your dad's lobster bisque.
You know, it was a big day when he would do that. It was like a really kind of really special day because we didn't have a lot of money to buy the lobsters.
Mm-hmm.
And coming from the Maritimes and being kind of like landlocked in Ontario where we, you know, went to high school and like lived most of our lives out there. So it was just like a really nice day. And it was like the recipe is a big cooking recipe. So it was like an all day kind of thing for my dad.
Uh-huh.
And it was just one of those things where one of those things where you watch your parents or watch your father really enjoy doing something. And I think like that's something that I didn't write about too much in the book. And now I'm just thinking about it. But just watching your dad be very happy with himself is one of those true, honest cooking moments. And I think like that's kind of one of the nicest things where like dads always are just like, I'm on the grill. Or, you know, like dads usually have their like one or two moves that they pull out.
Yeah, it's like, this is the thing.
And and my dad's a very, very good cook, actually. But the lobster bisque is something that he just took pride in, and it was like technique driven. And my dad's like an engineer, and he's definitely a very intelligent guy. He's one of those guys who just reads everything and retains it.
Mm-hmm.
And I always felt like kind of dumb around him. And so I think just like watching him make the lobster bisque growing up, and then going to cooking school, and then helping him, you know. And then now I can just like whip up that lobster bisque like way faster than him because he likes to he'll do it and it'll take forever. And I'm like, I can make this in, you know, a couple hours, no time. But he'll like wake up in the morning, you know, he's like, okay, I'm going to wake up at like 6 and this is going to take 12 hours to make a friggin' lobster bisque. And that's the cool thing about food and food memory and like how you always have these little pockets and things just drop. Like it's always like the sand sifting and you just open up a little crack and some different sand comes down, you know?
Sure.
And it's just like, I think like the one thing is about that lobster bisque It's just seeing my dad be really happy with himself and being like really present and watching him. You know, a lot of dads work really hard and a lot of families work really hard, and he was always that guy. And so like for him to kind of just have that whole day to himself making a creamy lobster soup is pretty funny, actually.
Yeah. But it's also beautiful. And that's...
It is.
You know.
It's okay to be beautiful. It's okay to be masculine. It's okay to be beautiful. And it's okay to be beautiful, vulnerable, and, you know, be a man.
Maddie, you're beautiful.
Oh, Francis, we're best friends.
Thank you for talking with us. Happy holidays,
Absolutely.
Brother.
Absolutely. Happy holidays to you. Ho, ho, ho.
Maddie Matheson is author of Maddie Matheson, a cookbook. He's got a recipe for his mother-in-law's bologna bowl. And as Maddie put it, if that can make him a New York Times best-selling author, anyone can do it. He also left us with a recipe for that wrappy pie, and if you want to live like a Canadian Maritimer, you can find it at splendidtable.org. Coming up...
Listen, the real talk is I have like my own crazy things that I whip up over the holidays, but this cutout cookie is my family tradition. It's my family recipe, and it for me screams holidays.
That is the sugar queen herself, Christina Tozzi. And I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters, and I'm your host, Francis Lamb. There are a lot of ways to get to know Christina Tozzi. You might know her as a judge on the show MasterChef, or you might know her from the show Chef's Table, or you might be riding off a sugar high right now from something from one of her milk bar bakeries. But to me, after editing her book, All About Cake, she will forever be cake nerd number one. And even though I feel like I know all of her deepest cake secrets, I still don't know what she loves to bake for the holidays. Christina Tozzi, queen of the cake, how are you?
I'm great.
So I'm going to ask you a question that I'm going to pretend I have like privileged knowledge on, except that it's only because I read your book six times. but I know that you grew up baking a lot with your family. You write about baking sheet cakes for the neighborhood and for the PTA. But do you have like special things that you and your family would make around the holidays?
Yes. We have a lot of family traditions in the kitchen.
Yeah.
The like standard in the household, no matter where you are, in my sister's kitchen, my mom's kitchen, my aunt's kitchen, is a very simple cutout cookie, like the buttery, snappy cutout cookie. Our family recipe is four ingredients. It's butter, light brown sugar, flour, and salt. No leaveners, no this, no that. It's super shortbready. It's super snappy. You have to roll it out thin. That's like, this is where my family, who is very much like, sugar, sugar, I'll take it where I can get it. This is like one place where they become a very fine tune in the technique of rolling it to the right thinness. And sometimes they get frosted, sometimes they don't.
And the idea is like, oh, it's thin. Because if you don't have leavener, then it'll be kind of like, tough, right? Kind of hard if you're not really rolling that thin, so it's nice and snappy.
Exactly. There's no leavener, but there's also no water content. So there's no egg, there's no milk, there's even vanilla extract. So what you also get is a really tender cookie rather than, if we're going to go really into like dorky baking mode, the second you add water content and that touches flour, flour is going to want to start to develop gluten. But because there is very little water content in this recipe, there's none from anything other than the butter, you get like an impossibly buttery, impossibly tender cutout cookie. And this is the holiday staple in my family.
Where'd the recipe come from?
My dad's mom, who my father is Italian. My dad's mom, who it came from, was Slovakian. And I mean, I don't know, from like the suburbs of Cleveland, Ohio, is where it came from, because that's where she was born and raised. But that whole spirit of like my family recipe, where you get super proud about the one recipe that your family nails, is this for us, especially during the holidays.
That's awesome. I had no idea. And I also have to admit, I would not have thought that for you. Like, it's so simple. It's
like it should be so much more elaborate.
Yeah, I mean, like the Tozzi cake, you know, like 14 layers, 3 fillings, 2 jams, 4 garnishes, and it's like,
listen,
no, our family thing.
The real talk is I have like my own crazy things that I whip up over the holidays, but this this cutout cookie is my family tradition. It's my family recipe, and it for me screams holidays. Like, I crave it. We make it in crazy amounts. And then the other like pro tip is that you eat them directly out of the freezer or out of a cookie tin that sits outside, because it's so cold in Virginia and in Ohio, where my family is all located, that like you have to run outside to the garage or to the side yard or to the deck, because a family that's serious about the holidays does too much cooking and too much baking, and you use your outdoor resource as your refrigerator, your freezer. Like, that is a holiday in a nutshell. I need nothing other than that to just make my heart feel like it's at home this time of year.
Oh, you mentioned you have other things that you make for the holidays now.
Well, so I'm always split during the holidays, because inevitably, real talk is that I never show up anywhere empty-handed. It's the thing that my mom and my grandma instilled in me at an early age. The other reality is that people expect me to bring something from Milk Bar because it's my bakery, and I do so happily. But then for me, the spirit of the holidays is me spending all my free time in the home kitchen. So whether I'm invading someone else's home kitchen or I'm having people over, in the morning, I always make cinnamon buns, like the morning of Thanksgiving, the morning of Christmas. I always make cinnamon buns, which means I stay up late the night before getting the dough ready and getting all the getting all the fixins ready. And then for the main event, I'm not going to lie, I go a little crazy. I will either like ship ingredients to wherever I will be, or go crazy grocery shopping, which is also part of the fun of like waiting in a really long line at the grocery store. But I'll do everything from, I have like a triple layer cheesecake that I've been making since I was a teenager. I also have this pie that I've been making since I was also a teenager that basically is like a chocolate cookie crust. And then I take a tub of Cool Whip and I fold in like melted down Hershey's Kisses. And then I chop up a whole bag of Reese's peanut butter cups and put them as a layer in between. It's basically a chocolate peanut butter pie, but it was the thing that I would make before I actually truly knew how to bake. I just knew I loved bake. And these are two items that are often requested from my family. But then I also just go crazy. Like, if there is an extra stick of butter, I'm making cookies. I'm doing like, I'm freeing. I'm like, you know, free associating this butter into another baked good, because it's the time of year where I feel most like myself.
You got some Hershey's Kisses? I'm ready to make a pie. Like,
yes. Yes. That is how it goes. Okay. Or my mom will be like, I got the Hershey's Kisses and the peanut butter cups. Let's do this.
Let's do this. It's on.
And by let's do this, she's like, I'll sit and ask you questions about your life while you make this pie.
Yeah, well, I think that's actually really lovely, right? Like, that's one of the really lovely things about having holiday, especially baking traditions. So, okay, so it is the holidays, and I'm thinking about gifts. Every time I walk into my local neighborhood Milk Bar, and, you know, I see your smiling face on the wall, I outside of the pastry case, I know you have all these like things like fun mixes and little tasty things. I think of them almost like as dessert condiments.
Yes.
And I thought it'd be so rad to make jars of these things as gifts.
Yes.
What do you think,
Francis,
are,
like, I really like where you're going with this.
So what do you think are like great little things you can make and hand out?
I'm a really big believer that the best gifts are like the most thoughtful and most human. And I think nothing trumps something to eat that is made in your kitchen and that is thoughtfully put together. It doesn't cost a lot, but I think it says so much more than money can put a price tag on. A jar of cookies or a tin of cookies, little ones, doesn't have to be a big batch, but scooping them out small and making them into this really thoughtful, purposeful nibble of a gift that I think is really powerful. I'm a really big fan of rosemary nuts. This is something that my sister used to make as a teenager. They're sort of like a sweet and salty mix of nuts with some chopped up rosemary in them. That in a fun container is really sweet. When I give gifts, I also sometimes I will give like the finished product. Sometimes I'll give like the mix itself, whether it's like a confetti cookie mix or something that kind of encourages a community within the recipient's kitchen. It's even more fun when you pair it with like what the recipe needs, whether it's like two sticks of butter and an egg or something that most people wouldn't go the extra mile to give. Or I'm also a really big fan of like giving a cookbook and two or three, I don't want to say hard to source ingredients, but ingredients that you wouldn't normally stock in your own cupboard. So a lot of our like secret weapon ingredients at Milk Bar are super simple. It's either really nice, like European style butter, or corn powder, which is freeze dried corn that's just ground up into a flour. Mm-hmm. Something that like helps get them to the next stage of the book or the recipe if they're really big fans of cooking or baking themselves. But nothing beats a batch of like birthday crumbs that you put in a sweet little container that just kind of like lets your recipient in on like, these are my favorite snack. Like, I hope yeah. they're yours too, in a way that you, again, money can't buy that. And there's a connection where you're sharing a little bit of yourself.
Yeah,
I love that. Cake truffles is a really great one too. It is the nibble of cake that we make at Milk Bar with what is essentially cake scraps, though we make so many of them that we bake cake just to mush them into cake truffles. But I think it is the most fun activity that like you could get into with your family. You take cake, whether it's fresh cake or store-bought cake or what have you, and you mix it with some moisture-added flavorful ingredient, whether it's strawberry milk or coffee or beer or raspberry jam, until it's moist enough to form its own ball. And then you dunk it in a super thin layer of chocolate, and then you roll it in something crunchy or sandy that has its own edge of flavor that makes sense with the overall cake truffle. One of my favorite moves is just taking a standard angel food or vanilla cake, mixing it with an orange or tangerine jam until it's moist enough, dunking it in a little white chocolate, and then rolling it in some toasted coconut. It's like the most perfect, magical, sort of like snow-dipped bite of cake that is perfect if you're hosting or perfect to give as a gift.
Cool. Well, thank you.
I'm getting very excited. I'm like going to literally sprint out of here and into my kitchen.
Okay, well, happy holidays. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
You too, Francis. Take care.
Christina Tozzi's newest book is all about cake. And in the spirit of giving, she left us with her master recipe for cake truffles, a recipe for those birthday crumbs, and of course, her family's cutout cookies. They're all at splendidtable.org. When I was a kid, the prized gift for my family was this box of chocolates, a specific box of chocolates. They were these incredible, crispy balls of smooth chocolate and nuts. They were either Italian or French. We couldn't pronounce their name, which meant they were classy. So every time we had family visiting, or if we were going somewhere, my parents would go to a Chinese supermarket to get these chocolates. Now, fancy chocolate wasn't really a thing in Chinese food, so I always thought it was a little funny that they would only find these things in Chinatown. And weirdly, even though they were European, none of the white kids I grew up around had ever heard of them. Now, fast forward 30 years later, and I'm reading a story by the writer Liana Agajanian, whose family is Iranian-Armenian, and she's talking about this box of chocolates that were a big deal in her community, and I'm like, wait, what? And she goes on to say that these chocolates are also hugely important in Indian communities and Libyan communities and all these communities around the world. And so I had to talk with her about this gift that we all kept on giving. Hey, Liana, great to have you here.
Hi, Francis. Thank you so much for having me.
I am so excited to talk with you today because, you know, I used to feel like I had this small but kind of special secret from my youth as a Chinese-American kid. And here you write the story about having the same special secret as an Armenian-Iranian American. So do you remember the first time you had a Ferrero Rocher?
You know, I don't remember the first time because it was such an omnipresent thing in my life that it just always seemed to be there. But I felt like it was a special secret as well when I was growing up. And for me personally, because there are so many layers involved in the actual chocolate, I would eat it very slowly to make sure that it lasted really long and that I could taste each individual layer on its own.
Yeah, I totally remember doing that. Oh my God. For us, it was like, I don't remember when we first saw them. It was like sometime in the 80s. So I was like a little kid, and all of a sudden they were everywhere. Like every time one of our cousins or aunties would come over, they would bring a box. It was like the classy gift to give. And so then you became like, you had them and then you would bring them to other people's homes. It was like this currency of this particular brand of chocolate. And again, I thought it was like a Chinese thing because it was only Chinese families I knew who did this.
You know, that's one of the things that really surprised me as I was writing this piece and the reaction afterwards, that it was just this thing that so many immigrant communities and people around the world kind of shared. And I think everyone thought that it was their special secret until they found out, wait a minute, we were all doing this at the same time. but yeah, it was, you know, a lot of these cultures, including my own, are very heavy on hospitality. That's a big deal. It's a way that you show respect. You're very hospitable to both family, friends, and strangers. And so if someone was coming over to your house, you would have that out. And if you were going to someone's house, you would for sure have to take something. And what could be better than a glass-looking box with 48 pieces of little individual chocolate hazelnut balls in it, all wrapped in gold, that you'd have to carefully open and eat. It was just a currency. It was just a way for you to show that you really cared about this person.
And so when you wrote your story, you researched why it was this particular brand of candy, right? Because, yeah, it was this candy. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like any old nice box of chocolates. It was always Ferrero Rocher. And again, for me as a Chinese American, for you as Armenian Iranian, but in your story, you had people who were Indian. I have to tell you, actually, when I brought this story up, one of my colleagues, Erica, whose family's Colombian, she's like, oh my God. And she told us that she is setting the tables at her wedding with this candy. So like, this is such a thing for so many different immigrant communities. Why is that?
That's a great question. I think a large portion of it has to do with how Ferrero Rocher marketed themselves very cleverly. They, I think, had a plan to be global. And they did very clever marketing where they attached the candy to holidays. So, for example, Ferrero Rocher has a huge presence in India. And so when it was Diwali, they would make commercials and have been making commercials saying things like, Ferrero Rocher is precious, just like your family. And so this chocolate started becoming associated with that relationship. And then, you know, I think that they really played up on the European element, the refinement of, you know, what Italian rich quality chocolate could be. And you see a lot of that featured in their commercials where there's a chef in the kitchen who's really taking the time with like a pair of tweezers to make sure that every little bit of hazelnut or whatever they're doing is very, very well placed. Perfect. Yeah. On every like chocolate that they're making. So it really kind of set this precedent where if you bought Ferrero Rocher, you were buying something that had a really special touch to it. And you were buying it because this chocolate is precious, just like your family. And at some point they entered the American market and have now become a really mainstream part of the offerings that you can buy in a drugstore.
Yeah, they got a drugstore. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I mentioned in my piece that it wasn't like they were the only ones. There's Godiva too, right? That is also associated with a very refined taste.
Right.
But Godiva opened stores in malls. And so Ferrero Rocher was much more accessible to a wider range of communities, and especially the immigrant communities who would, you know, have access to them in the drugstore sooner than they would in a mall.
Yeah. And it really sort of like reinforced this idea of like, oh, America, it's like the streets are paved with gold and you can get Ferrero Rocher at a drugstore.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah.
Well, anyway, well, what a great gift. I hope you get many boxes of them this holiday season.
Thank you. I hope you do too. It's become a thing that I do now. You know, I used to kind of laugh at it and just think that it was something my parents did. But as we all know, we all turn into our parents. And now I take that when I go to someone's house.
Yeah, you gotta lean into it. Thank you so much for coming in, Liana.
Thank you so much for having me.
Liana Agajanian is a journalist and writer who's tracing the Armenian immigrant experience in America through food. Project is called Dining in Diaspora. Coming up, the chef Victor Albizu with his holiday must-have, Ajiaco, a Peruvian pepper and potato soup. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. You know, one of the things that's so great, I think, about the holidays is that they can seem so universal, but At the same time, so many people have their own way of celebrating them. The chef Victor Albizu in Washington, D.C. is someone I knew I wanted to talk to because he runs a Mexican restaurant, but he was raised by a family that's Cuban and Peruvian. And his favorite Christmas dish is a little potato soup he learned to make by the side of the road in Peru. So we met up with him in his restaurant Taco Bamba to get a lesson in making it, and it was such a great time once we got over the fact that it was so hot in that kitchen that the microphones literally started to melt. But he was so into it, and he was so proud of the fact that he could find Peruvian potatoes to show us what they really tasted like. Have a listen. So Chef Victor, thank you so much for having us today.
Thank you guys for being in my chaotic kitchen. I'm really grateful to have you.
Taco Bamba, lunch prep is definitely in full swing.
It is.
But we're not going to talk about the restaurant. We're going to talk about your home.
Yes.
So you grew up in a family that was part Cuban and part Peruvian.
Yes. Lots of flavor, lots of talking and yelling and loving.
So what was like holiday time at your table like?
It's evolved over the years.
Yeah.
When I was younger, it was really about like the classics. The Cubans did the roast pork the best way, so everybody let them do it. The Peruvians did all the other, the potato dishes, the starch, the sides, the creamy dishes, the ceviches, the kind of stir fries, all that kind of stuff would find its way under the table.
Yeah.
We would do papas a la huancaína or causas, all these potato dishes. And
what's papas a la huancaína?
Papas a la huancaína, there are 3,000 varieties of potato native to Peru.
Yeah.
And papas a la huancaína is a classic dish, steamed or boiled potato with the cheesy ají amarillo sauce.
Yeah.
Ají amarillo is the one of the preeminent chilies or peppers of Peru.
Yeah.
It's in our dish that we're going to make today. But Peru is has a very special soil. The things that come out of the ground in Peru are unlike any other place in the world. But it is also a place that has struggled with poverty and a lot of different kind of crises.
Yeah.
So you'll see that the use of these products are elevated. It's kind of this beautiful kind of dichotomy of inherent elegance and kind of, poverty and and do what you can with what you got.
Yeah.
And this dish that we're doing today is a dish that I now serve at the holidays with my family to get started because this is a dish that I ate out of a bucket in Ayacucho, Peru, on the street. And I found the flavors to be just profound, and really this reminds me a lot about where the vast majority of Peruvians are still and how wonderful their food is and how wonderful their products are and how proud they are of it.
Let's talk about this dish. What is it called and what are we making?
So this is called ajiaco. Okay. So again, we just talked about ají amarillo. This is ajiaco. Ajiaco is basically just a chili stew with potatoes, and I was able to get a hold of actual Peruvian potatoes. And this is oyuco, which looks kind of like a potato, but it has this kind of crumbly, slimy nature to it almost.
Yeah, this is
You can eat it raw or you can eat it cooked. It's an Andean tuber.
Yeah, it looks like a really smooth, waxy potato.
It's actually not one of the varietals of potatoes. It's not a potato at all. Hmm. But it does add a certain authenticity of flavor to what we're doing.
Oh, cool.
So I'm going to chop up some garlic here. These are whole ají amarillos. We have farmers in the U.S. now that are growing these. There's a little heat to them. You're welcome to taste it like that if you like.
Thank you. You can find these jarred sometimes too, right?
Yeah, we bought them jarred. You can find them in puree form as well, which is the way I kind of grew up using it. So I actually had to get used to using
the fresh ones.
The whole ones. Yeah, yeah. Definitely. And controlling the heat a little bit with the seeds, but I really like the seeds and I like the heat. I'm really into spicy food. It really makes you feel alive, I think. Yeah. I don't hold back.
Pain means you're alive.
I agree with that. I agree with that. I'm also going to chop an onion.
Okay.
So I have some pork fat that we've rendered.
Some pork fat in a nice sauce pot.
Yeah, and I'm going to go ahead and actually add a piece of pork to the pan.
Okay. Is that like a salt pork or just like a hunk?
This is just a hunk of pork.
Shoulder.
Yeah, yeah. Shoulder that, just to add a little...
A little something something?
Yeah. In Peruvian food, you don't see a whole ton of like this hard searing. And so we're going to go right in with the onion.
Okay. Yeah, so you don't need to like brown that pork super hard.
No, we're just going to let it be.
Just let it go.
Yeah, we're just going to let it be. And I'm gonna actually add the garlic relatively early.
Okay.
Instead of letting it kind of bloom by itself, I kind of mix it with the onions and just kind of let it get where it needs to get while the onions get translucent.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know already that when you smell onions and garlic in a pan with a little bit of pork fat, that you're on the right track.
Everything's all right.
Everything is good. The world is in the right place. Even though it's not.
Yeah. It's the holidays. Positive thoughts.
That's right. That's right. And I'm going to start adding the ají amarillos to it as well.
I want to talk about the ají amarillos for a second too, because they're this beautiful orangey yellow color. And they have a little bit of heat. They're not crazy hot at all, but they have this beautiful, very fruity, passion fruity.
even the hottest peppers in Peru, like the rocotos or the ají limos, they all taste, you know, just like they're just a step away from a passion fruit of some sort, or you know, right? There's just a little something in there that makes you feel good about yourself when you have it. So I love that about it. It's not like this, like, all out warfare. it's a really beautiful thing. And since we're gonna finish the dish with some olives, I'm gonna add a little bit of olive oil if I feel like the pan needs it.
Yeah, just a little more.
Just because, you know, in my culture, growing up, I would never use olive oil cooking, and now it's almost all I use. But that was like the finishing oil. That was like the sacred
fancy stuff.
So I'm going to go in with the potatoes.
Yeah. Are these pre-cooked?
We blanch them. You don't need to blanch them, but we blanch them, and we have that blanching liquid that I'm going to re-add here.
Okay.
All right, so I'm just going to cook these down, and I'm going to add the oyuco as well.
The oyuco is cool. I snuck a bite of that earlier raw.
Yeah, it's
potato-ish, but it has like almost like a water chestnut-y flavor.
That's exactly right.
A corn flavor.
Yeah, and I just added some bay leaf. So here I like to start, I kind of take this and break it up.
You're sort of mashing them, crushing them while you're cooking them, kind of.
Right, it's almost like risotto style, right? Where where you don't really want to stop too much. You want to just keep accentuating and building the starch up in the dish.
Yeah.
I'm going to add a little bit of paprika here.
Okay.
And then now I'm going to start adding the potato stock that I blanched the potatoes in.
And this could just be water.
It could just be water. It could be chicken stock. Yeah. And this starts to pick up some of the flavors off the bottom there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So this is what you're talking, like risotto style with the potatoes.
Right, you see? Sorry, it starts to break it all up.
Yeah. So you're leaving some of these potatoes like golf ball size, some of them are mashed up.
Yeah, I'm going to let them fall apart and change in texture on their own.
So if we're not using Peruvian potatoes...
I would use a good Yukon Gold potato.
Yeah, sort of like a waxy, not a totally waxy potato.
I mean, this would be a great thing to do also with like fingerling potatoes.
Great.
Because those are a lot more even, and they have a beautiful sweetness to them.
Yeah. Man, that smell is awesome.
Yeah.
Like it went from that like sautéed garlic and onion smell, which everyone knows and loves, so now it's like the potato stock and the starch. Oh man, it's good. The color is great. I mean, it looks like this beautiful, like almost like a yellow lentil kind of
color. Yeah, it's got this
color.
You know, it's got a really porridgey, but like vibrant porridgey looking vibe to it. And in a minute here, when I get more of this stuff broken up, I'm gonna add the evaporated milk. If I can find, here it is. The evaporated milk is something that is uber used in Peru.
It's almost like a caramelized milk flavor.
Exactly.
It's not that sweet, but it has that like nuttiness.
It's almost like a concentrated.
Yeah. So what are the next steps?
Well, we continue to stir. Basically, until the potatoes are all broken and done, I actually like to finish with a little bit more pork fat in here.
Stirring in a little bit more.
Yeah, just to help it out a little bit. So actually, before we finish it, I'm gonna. I have some Peruvian purple potatoes over here.
Okay.
Some queso fresco.
Okay.
Right. And I'm gonna toss in here with
fresh,
that
mild cheese.
Right. I'm gonna toss some cilantro in here as well.
Okay.
I take some cilantro stems. It's one of my favorite ingredients right now. Mm. I use them like a little chives. Peruvian olives, and I'm gonna take a little bit of lime zest.
Okay.
And again, maybe this isn't how they would serve it in Peru, but I love it like this.
So this is like a little garnish for you.
This is our little garnish, yeah. Let's season it up a little bit. All right. And then I also have this little secret that I like to do, where I take some Peruvian olives and I dehydrate them. Obviously, Peruvian grandmothers are not doing this.
Yeah.
but it turns this into this really pretty, almost like black olive puree, oil type of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just
dehydrate them and blend them.
Yes, with olive oil.
With olive oil. So he's put the soup in the bowl. This beautiful pale orange potato soup. It's almost like a chowder.
Yeah.
Put out a few spoonfuls of this potato and cheese and lime and cilantro salad, and then a few drops of this black olives pureed with olive oil.
A little more cilantro stem, a little bit more
lime zest.
And I'm going to chop a little piece of lime in case you want to put a little bit of that in there. And I have some really pretty cilantro.
Now, all this stuff you're doing at the end, this is your own addition.
Yeah.
Traditionally, it could just be the soup.
Absolutely. I'm the kind of guy that keeps adding.
Yeah.
Then you can also add some really nice pieces of fresh ají amarillo also. Now you get to taste it.
All right. This is the moment. Oh, dude. Mm. I wanted to try the soup on its own without all the garnishes. And it's... If you said, it's just a simple potato soup, I would never believe you.
Right.
Because there's so much flavor from the onions, from the garlic, from the ají amarillo. Those chilies are so... It's crazy. Like, raw, they taste like almost like passion fruit.
Yeah.
But cooked. Then cooked...
It has a... What I like to describe as a rounder heat, right?
Yeah.
Rather than acute, it's rounder. It permeates in a beautiful way, in a subtle way. And you can tell that potatoes and ají amarillos are meant to be
together. They were like destined.
And of course, everybody has their own take on ajiaco. It could be a little bit looser. It could be more of a brothy soup. I like it like this. It packs a punch. It's a great way to introduce people into the holidays, into a beautiful meal. And when people appreciate it, it's all the more humbling because it comes from such a humble place.
Yeah. It's like literally chunks of potato stirred with water, and it's one of the most delicious things I've eaten all year.
I'm glad to hear that.
Happy holidays. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. We're really grateful to be able to do this with you guys.
Victor Albizu is chef owner of Taco Bamba in Washington, D.C. You can find his recipe for that pretty amazing potato soup, ajiaco, at splendidtable.org. And here's one last thing about gifts. If you're still looking for something for someone, we talk to our friends at America's Test Kitchen, who see pretty much all the new kitchen gear every year. Sally Swift put Jack Bishop on the spot for ideas from stocking stuffers to splurges.
Hey, Jack, nice to have you back.
Nice to be chatting with you, Sally.
So we are thinking about some gifts for the cooks in our lives, and you are obviously the person to come to. And I want to start out with how about something for a stocking stuffer. What have you found this year that you love?
So sometimes it's the small changes in your kitchen that make a big impact. We recently tested in the kitchen fruit and vegetable peelers, and I was pretty convinced that I knew what was going to win, and then I was totally surprised. It's one of these Y-shaped peelers rather than one where the blade is in the same alignment with the handle, and it's from a company called Kuhn Rikon. Perhaps the best thing about this is it's $3.50, and it comes in an array of colors, so you can pick up multiples of them. And it is so much more comfortable. I actually used it over the Thanksgiving holiday, where I counted 13 pounds of potatoes and 10 pounds of apples, which would normally cause a lot of hand pain. And it's just sharp and comfortable.
All right. Anything else for the stocking?
So this is somewhere in between. It will certainly fit into the stocking. It's called a slotted spatula, and the one that the Test Kitchen has recommended is from Wusthof. And they label it a fish spatula, which seems to be underselling it. It's thin and metal, and it's got slots for liquid or grease to drain out. And yes, it's great with delicate things like fish, but it does other delicate things like pancakes or cookies. And it's even strong enough to support heavier items. So if you want to flip burgers or cutlets, we love it because it's so thin that it gets right underneath the food without nicking the food or tearing off the crust on a breaded chicken cutlet. And honestly, it's the most useful of the world of spatulas is this Wusthof slotted spatula.
It does need a new name. That's all there is to it. It needs to be rebranded.
Yeah, I'm going to make that a campaign for 2019. You know, we're going to banish the word fish spatula.
What? So I think that something that people don't buy themselves in the kitchen are scales. Do you have a scale that you guys love?
Yeah, you know, if you're baking, you definitely need a scale. It's so much more reliable to be weighing your flour, mm-hmm. weighing your sugar. And of course, you know, if you're following recipes, you need to know, do I have 2 pounds of potatoes or 3 pounds of potatoes? And so there's a mm-hmm. scale that we love from OXO Good Grips. It's their 11-pound food scale, and it has a pull-out reading so that you can put a big bowl on the base, tear it, you know, hit that tear button to go back to zero, mm-hmm. fill it up. And even if the bowl is hanging over and you can't read the digital readout, you can just pull it out. It detaches from the base.
Oh.
And so you can
wow.
slide it to where you want it so that you can actually see, do I have 2 pounds of potatoes in that bowl or 3 pounds of potatoes in the bowl?
Wow, that is a great idea. All right. What about some high-end items? Do you have a couple things you love that would be a little bit of a splurge?
So the number one thing that I recommend to people if they don't have it is that they go and invest in a really good digital instant read thermometer. You know, I just don't understand.
That is the truth.
Yeah. I don't understand that you're going to spend $50, $75 on a beef tenderloin, for instance, and you're going to wing it or you're going to try to cut into it to sort of peek in. Mm-hmm. Use a digital instant read thermometer. You can use it for meats, poultry. We use it for sugar. You know, if you're making caramel, the temperature of water when you're making bread, the temperature of custards. And so the ThermoWorks ThermoPen MK4. Now, this is expensive. It's on $99, but it is kind of like the Rolls Royce of thermometers. It's what everybody mm-hmm. in the test kitchen is assigned when you get hired, and you guard it with your life.
Wow.
Because everybody loves these things.
Huh, I love it. And it's battery charged?
You actually swing out the probe. It's on a latch. And when you swing out the probe, suddenly the battery awakes, and it's now reading. It has an automatic shutoff to preserve battery life, and mm-hmm. it's got a nice thin probe that you can stick into all kinds of places to immediately get a reading, and it gives you a reading in about 2 seconds, so that if you're fussing over something hot, you're not waiting for the temperature to come up. It sounds like a small thing, but would you rather have your fingers close to caramel for 2 seconds or 10 seconds? I would vote for 2 seconds.
Exactly. I think that's right on. I know you guys have loved these for years, and it's time for me to make that investment, I think. So last but not least, what's a nice piece of equipment you think is well worth a splurge?
So when people ask me what's the, you know, skillet that I love or other piece of equipment, I say, just, mm-hmm. you know, do not ever take my Dutch oven away from me. I feel like it is the most versatile piece of cookware in my kitchen. Mm-hmm. For wintertime, it's all those stews and braises and soups. I cook pasta in it. I deep fry in it. I bake loaves of bread in it. And this is a place where, you know, I want to get this workhorse to last a lifetime. The La Creuset Dutch oven is our top rated. It is an expensive piece of cookware. It's over $350. But they are gorgeous. Mm-hmm. It comes in all those different enameled colors. You know, it's cast iron, but it's got that enamel coating so that it's easy to clean up and durable. And, you know, I'm fully expecting at some point, maybe 40 years from now, my two girls will be fighting over my Dutch oven.
Jack, these are great ideas. Thank you so much for coming in.
Have a great holiday, Sally.
Jack Bishop is Chief Creative Officer at America's Test Kitchen. You can find his gift list at splendidtable.org. And that is our show for the week. However you're celebrating, whatever you do, I wish everyone great meals, big laughs, and quiet moments with the people you like the most. Thanks so much for listening. You find recipes and info on all our guests on our website, splendidtable.org. Get registered for our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and take a look at our expanding video collection from Rene Redzepi to Jacques Pepin. And last but not least, download our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell, Jenny Lukey is our editor and technical director, Erica Romero is our associate producer, Chip Walton is our digital producer, and Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thanks to Michael Schweppe for recording our piece with Victor at Taco Bamba, one of the hottest places he's ever recorded. And thank you for tuning in. Happy holidays, everyone. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.